So we've got about 20 people here at Lake Junaluska. We had a wonderful week for our gathering, and this is our final evening, and we're going to do some memories of Master. And everyone's, you know, it's voluntary. You don't have to do it, but if you have a memory of Master you'd like to share with us, it would be great. The only thing remaining is, who goes first?
Thank you. Rudy Chesko here. Okay. The last time, you know, everyone gets to see Master before they go home. So we were fortunate enough, you know, a whole bunch of us were going home on a certain day, and I was waiting there, but I wanted to talk to Master because my cousin told me to say something to Master, you know, and I wanted to get Master alone so I could talk to him alone. So I let everybody go before me. But they wanted me to go before. And I said, he should go. No. Everybody kept on pushing everybody ahead of me. So finally, I was the last one. So I knew I had all that time left to talk to Master about this. So I got in front of Master and I said, Master, my cousin, you know, sends her love to you for you know, you're a great Master. And she has to pay homage to you. For being such a great master, you know. So he said, but I said, she was going to take the initiation papers, Master, but her husband, because of the meat stipulation, wouldn't take it, you know. And now their marriage is on the rocks, and he went with another woman, and they left, and, you know, so their marriage is almost breaking, you know. But so his hands went up in the air like an old prophet, you know, just like an old prophet in the end. He said, oh, they should never do that. That's the worst thing they could do. You know, just like the old prophets of the Bible, you know. He said, the worst thing they could do. I said, oh, all right, Master, you know. So he said, all right, look, he said, you send them the booklets, you know, and things like that, and they'll come around, you know, eventually. Okay. Well, to this day, they're still together anyway, so, yeah. But anyway, he's there, and he's saying, okay, now, I'm going to give you a prashad, you know. So I told most of you the story, you know. So Jerry Turk had said, oh, put your hands in front of you, receive the prashad right in front of you, and there it is, you know. Put your hands down and wait till Master drops it in your palms, you know. And sure enough, Master raises the prashad way overhead, and he's holding up there for I don't know how long, and it just seemed to get longer and longer as he held it up there. So I looked at, what is he doing? He knows I want this prashad. So why has he got it up there? So I grabbed it, you know. I just grabbed it and held it. I took it down, and he looked at me, gave me a big smile, you know. So that was fine, you know. So then I was really filled up, you know. I got everything I needed from Master. Now, anyway, I leave and I go back, and then I meet Steve Malik. But anyway, first I just like to read a little thing. First of all, we should forgive and forget the past. That's the most foremost necessity. Many misunderstandings creep up, and majority of them are due to hearing through the ears of others and seeing through the eyes of others. Take it as if they had not told you, and then you will be all right. Don't believe what others say, you know. So anyway, unless you have seen something with your own eyes and hear it with your own ears, don't believe it. And if someone tells you something unbecoming, know that that man has different moods, and we are not perfect. If we have love for others, that love beautifies even the worst things. So you have to see from that level. That's the only way. So most of you know Steve Malik, right? Who has been with the Master in India for many individual experiences he's had, being a beautiful initiate of our Master, and as a traveling companion with the Master on tours. And to me, as a young initiate, someone to be revered and respected. And throughout the years, I've known him as a treasured brother and friend. So this incident occurred one evening after I said my last farewell to Master at Sawan Ashram at the Unity of Man. So I'll just tell my own way, all right. So anyway, I go outside and I meet Steve, and you know, I got everything from Master. And I looked at him and he says, you know, Russell Perkins, he's getting something from Master right now, you know. He's getting his blessing. You should get it too. Why should he get all the blessings, you know? You should go get some too, you know. So, me, I love Steve, you know. I was just on the path, brand new. So I said, okay, I guess you must know better than I, you know. So I start walking back, you know. I said, okay, I'll go. And there's Russell Perkins. I walk in, and Russell Perkins is kneeling before Master. He's got little gifts from Master and everything. And I'm thinking, I shouldn't be here. Oh, I shouldn't be here. You know, this is not right. You know, but anyway, I kneel down, and I wait there, you know, and he's talking to Master in a loving way and everything. I said, oh, God, I never should be here. So anyway, I'll show you something. Give me the book. I've got to pass it around. So all of a sudden, I get a notice from John McIntosh that Russell Perkins had written a new book, you know, called The Stumbling Towards God. So I'm going to pass it around to you. There it is, Stumbling Towards God. See that guy on the right side over there?
I see that same devilish
look. Right. Right. And, as soon as I looked at the front cover, I called St. Bonnie, and they sent me the book. They didn't ask me to pay for it or anything. They just gave me the book. And then I said, okay. You know, I got the book, and I said, gee, that jacket looks familiar, you know. There's that jacket on that guy. That's me over there. I was kneeling behind Russell Perkins doing that, you know. So I'm on the front cover of his book. He doesn't even know who I am, you know. So I felt like a ghost in there. I wasn't supposed to be there, you know. I wasn't supposed to be there. But anyway, that's the story. So don't see through the eyes of others, you know, because you could be misled, you know. So
early during the tour, 1970 tour, 1972, I developed a silly girl's desire for some personal recognition from the Master. I knew in my heart it was wrong. But we were receiving so much love and guidance. He was giving himself to us. One day, before the arrival of the Master for a talk, it was raining very hard. Virginia soils have an abundance of red-orange clay, and a puddle of it was forming at the bottom of the steps that Master was going to descend before entering the building. Master got out of the car and was walking slowly toward the top step. Everyone was looking with folded hands at the Master for his darshan. I, however, was looking at the puddle. It occurred to me that the Master would be walking in this puddle. I hastily looked around to find someone who would put something down for the Master's holy feet. No one was there. As Master reached the top step, attentive to his children, the blanket I was wearing came off my shoulders as if in slow motion. It was placed in the mud. I hurried back into the crowd so the Master would not see that it was me. Good luck with that. As Master slowly placed his holy foot on the blanket, he looked at it so humbly and with such a sweet look of acceptance. Then he looked right at me with the power of God in his eyes. I'm not exaggerating. He branded me with the information. It is God who blesses us when we are allowed to serve him. And there was also embedded in that information that Master was just an instrument of the Lord. On returning to the hotel, I placed a blanket out on the bed. It was saturated with the color of the clay. At the end of the tour, it was pristine, clean. I had never washed it. I'm very fond of bodies of water. So after the last talk in St. Petersburg, Florida, this one went out to the beach to look at the ocean. Looking out at the Gulf of Mexico gave me no pleasure. Something was missing. I turned around, and there was Master. In his room, by the window, sitting on his bed, talking to someone. After that person left, Master laid down. Then he sat back up and looked out his window. I said in thought, Master, I am so very, very far from you. To get to you is so difficult. And there are sharks in the water. Please, keep me at your feet. He took off his vest and turban, fixed his hair, and laid back down. The whole thing was just incredibly beautiful. After the Fort Lauderdale initiation, Master left from the Galt Ocean Mile at around 3 p.m. As he left his room, I was standing in the hallway trying to become one with the wall. Master looked at me. Brushed me with his hand and said, yes, God bless you. That day, there was no otherness. There was no other thought but the Master. There was no, this one is here, that one is saying this. This. Master was everything. The only awareness that I had was that I belong to him. He is everything. This awareness did not come from any effort on my part. He was holding me with his grace. During this state, the mind goes away. But during this state, for a few seconds, it came back, and it occurred to me that I should hold this moment forever. On the way to the airport, our car was alongside of the Master's. He was giving us darshan all the way to the airport. During when he was at the airport, enormous power came through his eyes, filling me with intoxicating bliss. He took the Master to another room, but he came back to give us his darshan once more. He walked through the crowd and away from our eyes. I can read if I can do this. This is an excerpt of Master's talk at Harmony Grove, California, December 15th, 1963. To the best I can, that which the God in my Master gave me is being extended to you with all love. With all the love he had for me, then with all that love he gave to me, with the same love, I pass it on to you. Live up to it, that's all. And I want you to be regular. I want you to introspect your lives, to weed out all infirmities day by regular self-introspection, and come in contact with the light and sound principles which are outward manifestations of God in action power. There is hope for everyone. Man can change, and you can change. God wills it. You can change. God wills it. There is hope. Don't be disappointed. Go jolly.
Okay. John McIntosh. When Master came to Toronto, it's the usual thing at the airport where you're trying to figure out where he's going to be and, you know, get there when he, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, at one point, for whatever, I was just on my own. I found an elevator, and the elevator opens, and Master's in there. Kana's there, Gyanichi's there. Seemed like half of India was in there, really, but I saw those three. There was this one Western guy coming out, kind of scurrying like a rat off a ship. You know, because he's in the elevator with Indian, you know, turbans on. He looks at me like, oh, God, this horrible experience of being in this elevator with all these Indian people. And kind of they're going to me to come into the elevator. And, you know, I could barely even stand up straight looking at what was in the elevator. I just said, oh, no, I'm not going to, because it was crowded, you know. So they went off, and I found a different way to get to where they were going. But it you know, we see Master, we see certain things, this and that. This guy spent an up and down moment with Master in an elevator, and he did not think he was enjoying it. What does he show you, this and that? And of course, when Master talks about it, he says he's trying to get your attention one way or the other. And he succeeded. You know, this guy is going to remember the experience. But it stuck with me, too.
Alan Nikomov, I'd like to tell of an experience, nothing but for my parents, because it demonstrates how Master does protect those nearest and dearest to us. And going back, I mean, now I'm old, I have older, I have children and grandchildren, but when I was, you know, young, when our group was first getting initiated, parents were very worried. They said, what is this? My Jimmy, my Sally is running around with a guru. What's going on? You know, what's happening to them? And Master would answer, your parents just want the best for you. So show them that you're doing well, and we'll come around. So in 1971, being with the times, we decided, myself and my wife, that we were going to renounce the corporate state in Chicago, and we headed to New England, where I went to school in University of Vermont. And sure enough, we found a house built in 1801, which we were able to purchase in Belmont, New Hampshire, right next door to Samington, which is in Bonnie, was. Due course of time, within a year, we get initiated. We have a baby. We have dogs. We have goats. A garden. Cats. And various, you know, wildlife living with us, mice and stuff, mice. By all measurements, a successful counterculture life. But my father, and I think rightfully so, said, you know, you really blew it. You could have been very successful and I would have helped you. And he was right, but he still loved me. And he was successful financially, and he helped us when he heard that we needed something, plumbing, roof, whatever. He would just say, okay, here's some money. I said, Master, I know you said there's give and take between parents, but I don't know if I should accept all this money. It's not that much money, but to accept this money. But yet, I couldn't tell my father and mother, oh, don't give me anything. I won't take it because I have a guru. Well, anyway, it came to pass that my parents visited us in Boston, and my mother related the story. Unbelievable. I mean, it's believable what happened. My dad liked to gamble, and we were living in New York, Manhattan, and he would take the express bus to Atlantic City, and he would do his gambling for the day and come back. So he went there to Atlantic City with his wife, my mom, and he has a system. I won't go into describing it, but he was very regulated. You know, he wouldn't lose much. He was only spending a half an hour at the shooting dice table. And either he would lose what he came with, or he would win big. So on this particular occasion, on his last roll where he would win big, he lost. He would say, okay, I lost. Then, well, I was getting ahead of it, because when he went back to his room, his wife, my mom, looked at him and must have seen some kind of change in him and said, I think you met Alan's guru. So he related the story that on his last roll of the dice, he lost. He says, I saw. He says, as I was leaving, this gentleman with a turban and a white beard, pretty tall, tapped me on the shoulder and pointed me to the table where I won. So I don't know what was behind that evening, the accounts that somehow the casino, even the accounts of what my dad gave to me, or however that worked, but Master did appear to my dad in Atlantic City gambling.
I was driving Robert Deem to the airport one evening, you know, so I took him to the airport, and he told me the story. He said that Master was driving a car down in Miami, and he was with some other initiates there, and he was looking up at the signs, and the sign said steak, you know, steak up there. So Master, in his own verbal vernacular, said, what is this steak? What is this steak? You know, what is that? So one of the men in the back said, oh, well, Master, it's, you know, you take a cow and then you put them on the board, you chop them up in little pieces, you know, and everything. And then, you know, you cut the pieces up in small things. And so Master, oh, steak, you know, oh, okay. But that whole thing gave me a whole insight into it, you know, because, you know, anything you contemplate, you know, you contemplate, you can't I forgot the exact word. Hold this just a second. I have it here. Let me see. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay. So it means, so anything you conceptualize, it's, you know, it's a desire. It's a desire there. So once you conceptualize it, you're making a statement on it. You're following it through. You're making a rotten out of a molehill, you know. You're taking it through. So think. That was Master's way of saying, don't go into it. Don't go into the subject, you know. So anyway, I was telling them the story at Stranahan Junior High School, you know. So I'm there just before I became initiated, and Master's coming in. So I went to get the books in front. They were selling books, you know, Spirituality and the Wheel of Life and the Mystery of Death, you know. So I said, oh, well, since I'm a novice guy, I better pick out Spirituality, you know, because Mystery of Death and the Wheel of Life is very deep, you know, so I won't go into that. So I took the book and when I sat down and I opened it up, and then this big light flashed out of the book, you know, jumps right out. And this Jewish fellow in the back saw it, you know, and I still to this day, he's a nice man, very nice man. He come and sat down next to me, and he said, you know, in this book it says here, you can take initiation as an experiment, you know, as an experiment. So he said, yeah. I said, well, you know, after that light shot out, I'm getting pretty well interested in this subject of Master, you know. So anyway, I said, okay, fine, you know. Master was coming down the aisle, and I was having thoughts about, you know, negative thoughts, and the negative power was pushing at me to give it up, you know. So it was surging up in me, you know. So I had all these vibrations in me that were negative, you know. And they were pushing me over to the aisle where Master was coming. And I said, don't push me here, because he'll know what I'm thinking, you know. And he'll see these negative thoughts, you know, he'll feel it. So sure enough, as soon as he got to me, he made a wide berth around, you know, made sure he flipped it, you know, and then he traveled on. Well, anyway, I was sure by that time, well, if the negative power was so against this man here, he must be the right thing, you know. He must have the right power, you know. So I said, okay, let me go check where the initiation place is going to be held. So I took the car and went over and checked it out, the women's club. I said, I know where it was. And then I rode back and I went for the second session. So this time, this nice Jewish fellow there, he says, Rudy, he didn't know my name really, but anyway, he says, young man, come here. He took the pillow. He brings it right in front of the lectern where Master's going to speak. He says, you sit down here, right in front of Master. He gave me some cashews because he knew I didn't have anything to eat, you know. And he said, you stay here. As soon as Master came, I was right under his feet, you know. And they wrote that story up and said, coming to Master's feet, you know. It's in one of the books, you know. So anyway, as soon as that happened, I had no feelings of any kind of negativity whatsoever. It was beautiful after that, you know. They took it all away. Just a beautiful thing.
Yeah. George Jones, who initiated me, was traveling with Master in a car. I'm not sure if this was in England or the United States. It had to be in the United States, I'm sure. And there was a big sign for 7-Up, you know, 7-Up, and big bottle and this great big sign. Well, India takes the British way of writing, and a 7 is a Z, is a Z, you know, in a lot of Europe at least. It was like this. So Master was saying, Zup, Zup, what is that? And so they're trying to, can you imagine trying to explain a fizzy 7-Up to someone? So they got him some Zup, which apparently he liked very much. And a story nowhere with no profundity whatsoever, as Amelia had talked about. But in St. Petersburg, my mother and I went down in 72 in in the Third World Tour down from Pensacola, and took a inexpensive flight, an inexpensive rental car, and an inexpensive place on the beach. And NASA was staying in a nice place on the beach, thank goodness. And after a talk, we waited down in the lobby because we heard that he will come down and give the darshan to initiates or to anybody who's there, you know. We waited and we waited, and it was kind of funny. There were other people around. There were probably about 20 of us. In every little corner in this lobby, you know, every place there was a sofa or something, there's somebody sitting there like this, and these other people are coming and going. And several times, it wasn't Mr. Khanna, and I don't know who it was, but it came down and said, "Master's not coming, leave, Master's not coming, leave." So about 11 o'clock, and it had been rather a long day and everything, and my mother wanted to stay. And I said, you know, we can't be, you know, this man. I didn't understand too much, but I knew he gives of himself, and it's late, and you don't want to be greedy, and you don't want to be disrespectful. And so we went back. So the next day, and I don't know who the group leader, I forgot who the group leader was in St. Petersburg, but we were at that house. And it was so beautiful, and it was outside in her backyard, and we were just full, you know, just at his presence. And then he had given prasad, you know, as a just a candy, and it was just, it was just too much. And we heard then that he came down the night before late and said, "Where are all my children?"
Ooh.
And we had left. So you think that night we didn't see it in the lobby. And we did. And he came down. And I have no earthly idea. There were about 20 of us, I guess. He was in a chair. And he came outside. It was like patio sliding doors. And we were kind of out on a patio there. And it seems to be it was in the front of the hotel lobby for some reason. And it was dark, and there weren't very many of us, and there weren't other people around. It was really rather nice. And I had no idea what was going on with me or in me or what he said or anything. But they got up to leave, and we got up, and I, who have never been drunk, was drunk as a skunk and could barely walk. And I almost got hit by a car in the parking lot, and my mother's kind of hanging on to me, you know. I don't remember driving down, you know, the road to the other motel. I don't remember much of anything, but if I ever write it up, I'm going to call his darshan when Master got me drunk.
I have a dog story. I told it to Rudy and Gloria, and it seemed to work. And anyway, my sister and her family are satsangis as well, and they had a dog back in the early 70s. And my sister Winnie had read where, you know, if an animal gets the darshan of the master, then the next birth is a human birth. Dog's part of the family, and, you know, what are you going to do? So they had a camper van type of thing, so they could travel. So they brought the dog, and they during the tour, they waited for a place where Master was outdoors and, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, they figured out the whole thing. And she went and got the dog and was at the back of the crowd and held the dog up so that the dog was in the line of sight, and then took him back to the camper, and that was that.
How long did it take the dog to die?
We'll get there. So later on, dog gets old. You know, they took the dog to the vet. The vet says, you know, he's not, you should put him down. They just couldn't do that. And they run a health food store, so they have herbs and stuff you can put on the body to, you know, keep things calm. So they kept him in the basement, you know, dying with all type of thing. So anyway, one night, their house is on a curve in the road, and there was a car accident in the middle of the night. And Wayne's husband, Jerry, goes out to see what's going on. And the car had gone the wrong way on the curve. You know, when you're going around the curve, you tend to go to the outside of the curve. This car went on to the inside of the curve. So he says, "What's going on here?" And the lady says, it was your house. This great white light comes out of your house. And Jerry knew. He went downstairs and the dog had died.
Wow.
You asked.
I just like to know the end of the story. Steve Melnick told you to go and get Master's blessing, and Russell Perkins was there, and you sat and waited. And then I would just like to know what happened.
Well, I stood up, and I stood up because I felt like I shouldn't be there. And I went just past the doorway. And Master, Russell Perkins, got up to go out. And then Master put his hands up against the door jamb. It was like a shock. Boom! He hit it with to keep Russell Perkins and the other fellow in there. You're not leaving, you know. He was being wonderfully kind. But that thing hit me like a ton of bricks. Oh, God. I shouldn't have been there. My whole body was like rigid. I was broken inside, you know. I said, oh God, I never should be here, you know. But it showed me how tender-hearted, how fragile I was, you know, and at that time. But anyway, a young couple was getting signatures for Master, you know. Master, would you sign this, you know? So that was it. I said, so I looked at him. I said, gee, if I had something to get Master to sign, you know. So the only thing I had was my passport. So I took it out, you know. I was going to do it, but I thought better of it, you know. I said, no, I better not let him sign my passport. Because you'll think it's like signing to go to heaven, you know. This would be it, you know. So I held it back, you know. I should have done it by now. He would have laughed. He would have really laughed at that. You know, so that was it. Then I went out, and that was the end of that. Yeah, but I always tell this thing, this story, because it's such a beautiful story of when I'm walking across the, the patio garden, a patio place where the courtyard. I'm walking across the courtyard, and all the people are going there to see Phil Perry, and Master usually goes there at night to tend to the sick people, you know. And everyone knew that Master would be there, you know, so they start crowding around him. And they start forming, blockages to where he was going. So I thought, oh, this is not right, you know. This is not right. I'm going to be noble. I'm going to my room, you know, leave these people alone, you know. I'm doing the right thing. I'm walking across the courtyard, and everything opens up. And sure enough, there's Master. His face is shining like Hieronymus Bosch painting, you know, Christ carrying the cross, you know, shining white, you know, beautiful face. And this thought transfer comes. Why don't you come and see the show? So I said, oh, Master wants me to see the show. There's something here. So, where am I going to see it, you know? I have to get up high to see this, so I climb up on the table, put my feet up on the table, get all the way up in the air. Steve Mellick thought I was crazy. And I said, some crazy nut jumped on the table, you know? But anyway, I got up there so I could oversee it. And sure enough, Master was there with Yogi Bhajan and Mr. Khanna, and he stopped for a second and talked, but I realized things were being orchestrated. And the whole thing was being orchestrated by the Master Power. And the chairs were brought. They sat down. One sat down next to the other, you know. And they started to talk. Master's hand went up in the air like this. There was a wire puller up in the air pulling his hand up. He was talking. Someone was making him talk, you know. Now, if I could live by that knowledge, that things in this world are being orchestrated every minute by the God power, that would be a wonderful lesson, you know. Really great lesson to learn. Yeah, so that was a great moment for me, a great lesson too. Yes, he was like a puppet, yeah, got in God's hands. He was being pulled everything was being orchestrated. Then everything cleared up, 1, 2, 3, they made a way for him, he went right away.
I've been married twice, and I'm thinking I can now give you my wife's various stories. My first wife, Diane, saw a master in 72 at San Bonnie, and it was outside there, and they're all waiting for master to come out. And she happens to spot that the dais up there is covered with leaves. It's in the fall, you know. Well, she's a housewife, a homemaker, stuff like that. So she finds a broom and sweeps the thing off, you know, of course. And she didn't think anything of it. She wasn't, you know, it was just, you're waiting and there's nothing to do. And you look at the thing and it's covered with leaves, you know. But when master comes out, it's, you know, because he would sit on the dais. And he found her. And he looked at her. And he looked at her. And afterwards, the people around her were saying, what did you do? So she had her moment. My second wife, Jeannie, you know how everyone wants to ask master a question. And one of the questions is, can we eat cheese that has rain in it? Can we eat cheese that has rennet? And every so often during our marriage, I'd say, oh, did you get to see, you know, what did you ask master? You know, this kind of thing. She'd get kind of miffed with me, like, oh, why are you asking this? Because she felt that she'd blown, she asked that question. And she felt she'd blown her chance. You know, I asked him the stupid cheese question. But master's answer, and it took me a long time to understand it. Master's answer answered everything. If it bothers you, don't do it.
My husband, Jim, was in India. This is secondhand from Jim. Was in India in 1967. And they were on tour with Master. And he and Helen Perkins were in a room. Jim told Johannes this story. I think he said the third floor of a school building, was it? Something like that. And so Jim and Helen, this was about 4:30 in the morning. They were sitting for meditation in the darkness, and then all of a sudden crows started cawing, dogs started barking, just a cacophony. And through the open window, Jim said he could see a black cloud come in, and he thought it was fear. There was an earthquake had begun. The building had begun shaking. And Jim said he was sure he was going to die right then and there, but that was fine. Master was just across the wall, just in an adjoining room, and that would have been fine. So afterwards, Jim asked, and Taiji was over there with Master in the room. Jim asked Taiji what Master did during that time, and Taiji said that she was shouting, and Master told her to be quiet, that she should always be ready for death. And later on, well, Jim said there were tremors all day, and Master was giving his talk, and he never batted an eye. Just, you know, Jim said every time a tremor came, everyone would, you know, look warily at each other, and Master would just continue speaking as if nothing at all had happened.
During the tour of 1972, by the time we got to Sant Bani Ashram, the Master had cleaned me up enough, filling me with his darshan, that I started to become intoxicated with his love. The only desire I had was to be in his holy presence.
One day at St. Bonnie, a day's talk was canceled because it was too cold for the sun god to stand outside. Now, I'm from Florida, and I never have been that far north, and I was freezing. Oh, my God. One of the initiates that was familiar with the St. Bonnie ashram grounds, who had lived at St. Bonnie for a while, showed me the little huts in the woods where people would meditate. So I settled in for an afternoon of meditation. And I had piles on me, coats, blankets. It took a while to get it all together. So soon, I heard someone playing the flute over the sound system. And then I had this overwhelming desire to leave and go back to the building areas. I didn't want to leave the meditation. After all the time it took me to get it all together, reluctantly, I unwrapped everything and made my way back to the building area. As I came around the corner of Master's house, I saw the Sangat all assembled for Master's talk. Suddenly, Master came out of the house and ascended the dais. He wasn't going to leave me out. Thank you, Holy Father. From St. Bonnie, we went to Vermont, to Kopal Ashram. We went directly to the house where Master was. I could see Master in the window, reading or writing by candlelight. I had a bad feeling about that. I was being disrespectful toward the Master by invading his privacy. I really had an urge to leave. So Master got up, came to the door, and he said, "You need to all leave. We will see you tomorrow." On the way to Cincinnati, Ohio, the driver in the car was speeding in excess of 100 miles an hour in order to meet the Master at the airport. As a passenger in the back seat, I was concerned but kept quiet. Carol, sitting next to me, was meditating. She opened her eyes and told Doris, sitting next to the driver, Bill, to tell him to slow down. He didn't. Again, and much louder, she repeated to slow down. The driver put on the brakes to slow down. Immediately, the semi-truck that was beside us passed us and then began to swerve into our lane in front of us. He righted the semi and we all kept going. Carol became very emotional and said that she had seen in her meditation the accident that could have been happening to all of us. She said she had seen this before in her meditations at home. We were all very grateful to the Master for his protection and for eliminating this bad piece of karma. So much is given through Master's eyes. In Denver, I was aware. I never realized how beautiful his eyes are. One woman asked Master if he takes on the karma of his initiates. Master looked straight at me. The only thing I can remember is that the more you come in contact with the light and sound, the more is burned away. Master gave a talk about love and sacrifice The talk was so beyond beautiful. Master was talking about love and sacrifice. Master became golden white light, and the light emanated out of him into all that were present in the room. One of the most precious gifts on the tour was when we were able to be in his presence with only a few initiates. Usually no words were spoken, only darshan. Master was flying out of Denver, and some of us went to the airport for his darshan. Only a handful of initiates were there. His eyes were so penetrating. Master gave a lot of darshan to one person, I think who was from Denver. His eyes surged so much power, you could actually see the power. It is tangible, kind of like waterless water that is cleansing love. Master gave me the most powerful darshan up to that point. I began to leave the body. As I got up to leave, I couldn't walk, so I just kind of stumbled around. Some of the affiliates of the Denver Satsang asked me and my traveling companions to San Francisco, Carol and Doris, if we wanted to meditate in Master's room. Of course we did. After meditation, and I was sitting right at Master's bed. I was on the floor, right where Master had been. After meditation, and as we were leaving, I found two grape seeds that Master had left on the floor. I said to myself, but Master, there are three of us. I found one more. Seek and you shall find. We were so full of Master's charging on our ride through the great continental divide to San Francisco. During one intense snowstorm through the mountains, Carol said, and this was whiteout. We were in absolute whiteout conditions, and we were traveling in a blizzard. Carol said she could see a white dove flying in front of us, leading the way. One more. We made our way to a Boy Scout camp in San Francisco. I walked into the kitchen, and the people there asked me, was I looking for work in the kitchen? So I spent the next 3 days chopping beets, grinding sesame seeds, serving soup and salad. One day in the kitchen, Barbara gave me an apple and said it was parshat from Master. She said the kitchen help was invited to a private darshan at the group leader's house. I put my apple aside on the shelf, and someone else got it. That night, I went to darshan. Master said that the kitchen help was supposed to get double, so he threw the apples in the box for all of us with both hands. I mean, like, boom, boom. At this darshan, Master talked so lovingly to a man sitting next to me. Master gave him a copy of Satsang Desh and a copy of Morning Talks. He signed the copy of Morning Talks and slipped it in his hands. Master said that he stayed with this man when he was in Pakistan.
Harcharan Singh showed a movie of Master's trip to Vancouver. I looked at Master's eyes. When the outer lights were out, Master's eyes had lights in them, little stars. When they all got up and he was walking out, Master stopped and said hello to me. Master said at the last talk in Denver, once someone is initiated by the Master, Tao has no power over you. The Master winds up your karma. No one can pluck those who are a saint's disciple from his hands. No power can do it.
At the ashram in India, I met Helen McDaniel, and she relayed this story to me when she was a driver of the Master. So they were in San Francisco somewhere, and they were going to a place, and they didn't give her the location, but the driver in the front knew the location of where they were going to go to end up at. And she was driving, Master was sitting right next to her. So they started out, and the driver took off. And as he got farther away from Helen, she had to speed up. So then she made little turns, and then the driver sped up a little bit more. So she was turning in and out, going like this, and speeding up and doing faster, you know, and slowing down and making turns, sharp turns and everything. She was getting really upset, you know. She said, oh, my God, I hope Master doesn't, you know, it doesn't look at the way I'm driving because it's really getting bad. So finally, at the end, she stops, and they ended up at the right place, and she looks over at Master and says, Master, how did I do? So he says, what do you want, a medal?
Yeah, I'm Dave Atterbury, and was initiated in 72, and my wife and I went down to Florida, St. Petersburg and Miami, and Charlotte, up in North Carolina. Today's meeting meant a lot to me, and when your statements are talking, I can relate to all of them, you know, how I felt and what I saw. And at the same time, it is real, but it's not real. I'm pulled in two different ways. First is how fortunate we all are to know of that love and that care and that support and that darshan and what he does. And this experience has brought a lot of those memories back. And I recall at one of the church meetings, I don't remember where it was, I was way in the back, and it seemed like there were thousands of people there, and I had this feeling that he wasn't paying me any attention. And I also was disturbed because I wasn't getting the great experiences as obvious everybody else was, right? So I had this attitude, you know. So I'm sitting in the back thinking that nobody is paying attention. It was a big mistake, because Master was paying attention, and I made a prayer, and I kind of just said, oh, poor me, I'm not getting the attention that I deserve. And all of a sudden, Master, to my view, stopped the procession and looked at me and said, you don't know who you're fooling around with. And he said, you want to know what God's like? You want to know God? I'm just going to show you just a little bit. And it was like a nuclear explosion, you know. I just grabbed a hold of me and worked me over and, you know, hit me on the head and pulled me, you know, just, and you know, I got that feeling, or he told me, you are selfish and you're stupid, And, you know, there were so many contradictions. The first thing was, I'd never seen a person, which it wasn't a person, it's obvious, who could be compassionate and loving and powerful at the same time, and to different people. I've never seen anybody have that compassion and love who could grab your heart and your spirit and do things that you didn't know could be done. But at the same time, I had this incredible feeling of this immense power that you did not want to fool around with, you know. And it was, I would almost say, dangerous to fool around with. It wasn't trivial. It wasn't to be trivialized. He was the power. He was the show. Everything was in his hands. Would you just get out of his, get out of the way, you know? And he did that in an instant. Just, it was amazing. And I've of course never forgotten that. But in today's video, watching that, the thing with the eyes, his eyes are like nothing I've ever seen, you know, and we all see that. I swear he was working on many planes at one time, doing 15 things simultaneously, or maybe 15 million things simultaneously. And there's nothing that I've ever seen in this world, or even read about, unless it's other masters, but you don't get it by reading it. You can throw all the books out. He was right. You know, you throw all the books out. You just get it by him doing that to you out of his compassion and his love and knowing what you need and his mission. And there's just, you know, words in essence can't even talk about it adequately. But it's just, it's a remarkable miracle that even in our lives, as old as I am, that I still remember that and see that and feel that. And I'm sure glad 47 years later, or however it is, you know, that hasn't left me, because I was afraid it was going to leave me, you know, that I was, after the tour was over. But it didn't. And it was through no effort of mine. It was what he continues to do with us and for us. So I want to thank everybody for talking about that, because if you don't talk about it and don't talk about how fortunate we are, and sometimes we, at least myself, get isolated, where we don't have that reality all the time. So this was very special. So thank you.
Master nailed me with a look in this cave in St. Petersburg. And I wasn't looking for, I was just looking at everybody and everything. And he was sitting one place and I was walking along a path or a patio or something. And I just turned, just looking at me. It wasn't with blessing. It wasn't with joy or happiness or a smile. It wasn't with a frown. I don't think it was with disappointment, but it was with knowing and knowledge, and just, and it's always been disconcerting to this very moment of how he looked at me and what he saw or didn't see, because other than, you know, being drunk and not even particularly feeling that as love before I got up and had all that darshan. But later, and I'm not going to talk about my side of it at all, so don't ask me any questions, but what, 18 months after that, something like that, Master died. And I didn't know he was dying at the time, but I was going through a really critical time in my life. And the fact that those two coincided at the same time in India and things like that was happening to me, and I thought, I wonder if that's what he saw, or I wonder if it's all my failures, past and present and future, that he saw. You know, you just wonder. But the way I've seen him constantly in my life has not been because of me and my inconsistencies. This is like testimony time, right? because of my lack of you know, consistency. But what I've seen in my life is just time after time after time with family, with people around me, with everything, just his saving grace for me time after time after time in this physical world. In this physical world. But yeah, he gave me a look. He went right through me. He looked right through me. And it was not joyful, but it is the kind of tie that we need to him, no matter what, you know, we perceive it as negative, positive, whatever, is that tie that we need with him, or whatever that is worth.
Family. I really love my mother. My mother's 99. She's still here. A couple of years ago, well, she had been to this gathering a couple of times. Some of you met her. And when I was initiated, I wrote to Master about my mother. I think my mother is so far ahead of, as far as man-making. She's love and just give and forgive. And I said, Master, may my mother have initiation. Well, Master wrote back and said, well, when your mother has read the books, when she understands the theory, she may then ask for initiation. Well, I give my mother books, and she doesn't read them. And, you know, years go by, and I said, you know, she gets older. And I said, well, you know, why don't you come see me? So I read my mother the books. And then she comes here to satsang a couple of times. And the last time that she was here on the way back home, I said, Mother, did you have a good time? And she says, you have no idea. I said, Mother, yes, I do. And I said, Mother, if Master was still in the body, would you ask for initiation? And she said, yes. My mother is in a home now. A couple of years ago when she was still at my sister's. I went to see her, and I put her to bed. And at this time, Mother is in dementia. She knows who we are, and that's it. And you can see the veil in the eyes. You know, there's nobody home. So I put Mother to bed, and I said, Mother, the Master is going to come for you. She bolted straight up, turned around to me, fully up there and aware, and she says, I know. The veil returned, and she laid back down, and I'm sitting there. What just happened? What just happened? It was for me to know that she is with the Master. I can now release her. And my attachment to all of that, wanting that for my mother. Like, it's kind of like the 26, well, I didn't tell you the story about the 26. Anyway, it was for me to know. Let go. She's Master's. Oh, one more thing. Steve Malik. Speaking of Steve Malik, he is the one who gave me I used to live in Miami, and we had satsang 4 or 5 times a week. We didn't understand what incredible gift we had. And every satsang that I ever went to in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, etc., well, not Orlando, but in the Miami area, Steve Malik picked me up and gave me a ride to satsang. So it may have been the last time I saw Steve, or maybe the time before.
I said, I told Steve. Well, first I asked him, Steve, do you remember me? Because there's a lot of stuff he couldn't remember from his heart attack. So, oh, yeah, I remember you. And I said, I know that we are supposed to give our thanks and gratitude to the Master. And you, and I repeated, you gave me a ride to every satsang. And he said, oh, you can thank me. You can thank me. So, these gatherings, for me, it's a spiritual shot in the soul. And I would like to thank Olivia and her husband, John Tiziano, for organizing this. And I would like to thank Christina also for all the work, and the board for all the work that you have done to bring these gatherings together. Thank you. And thank you, Master.
I'd like to tell you a story of how the telephone satsang got going. I've told this to different people at different times, and I realized that everyone likes to kind of know them. Someone contacted the board, probably around 2005, and just said, you know, there should be a satsang. Master says there should be a satsang, and, you know, golly, that's your job. Do it. So my usual is take all this stuff to the board meetings, and, you know, we all talked about it, and we all agreed, but, you know, we're spread out all over the country, all over the world. No one really, you know. We had used the conference call system a few times for board meetings and whatnot. I think we had a vague idea that that might be something, but no one volunteered to do it. But everyone agreed that, yeah, we should have a satsang. My pastor said so. So, okay, great. So sometime in early June of 2006, I get this call from Corey Tracy. And she's down in Florida, and she's a very strong personality. And she had heard about this two-person satsang that Barbara Ann Grimes and I had, which is basically a Sunday morning phone call, and we alternate reading something about from Master to each other. And Corey decided this should be a three-person thing, and Barbara Ann had already told me, no way, Jose, will we ever get beyond two people. She liked to keep it informal. She could be doing a reading and then halfway through talk about something else for 10 minutes, you know. Like, you know, that's just how she wanted to keep it. So I knew that I couldn't go back to Barbara with this thing. And Corey just wouldn't give it up. She was one of geriatric people, so he kept kind of the sense of it. And about 25 minutes into the phone call, I start laughing, and Corey goes, why are you laughing? You know, this is serious. I go, don't worry about it. I know what's going on. Masters is telling me to get the thing going. Don't worry. Now I know what he wants. It'll happen. She goes, what's wrong with you? I said, don't even think about it. And this was on a Saturday. I contacted Helen, who was chairperson of the board. We went through it. We both agreed, yeah, this is great. And the following Sunday was the first telephone satsang. We sent out we didn't have a real big email list at the very beginning, but, you know, we knew how to work the conference call system. At the time, the satsang plan was to simply have someone read at the start of the hour for 30 minutes. As that plan was being developed, I realized that people would be phoning in 5 minutes early, something like this. So I said, okay, I'll play a tape of Master so that people will know that they are at the right place. And of course, I was very inconsistent as to when I'd turn on the tape. It might be 10 minutes before, whenever. Little by little, as other people became involved, we decided that it should be 30 minutes before. And some people did come to me and say, oh, you know, you should announce that really the satsang does not begin on the hour, it begins on the half hour. But we kept it with the beginning of the reading, just allowing people to make their own judgment as to when they wanted to start, how much could they put into it. You know, you don't have to make it into a difficult job for people. And you know, after a little while, they'll figure it out. And we found over the years that, of course, the thing is happening. Two people are getting older. They have illnesses, weather where they cannot go outside anyway. If they were going to a local satsang, you know, big snowstorm, things like that. So it is kind of improving just as people have more of a need. And as it turned out, the thing that we didn't even understand at the time was that we had a legal obligation as a religious corporation to have regular spiritual meetings. So this kind of got us in line with the legal stuff. Yeah. So, and of course, the final note was when David Halliburton, who had joined the board, I'd gone through the various things that I do, and you know, David then volunteered to take over hosting the satsang, which was a job that I did not enjoy. So Master let me off that hook. So it just becomes more and more perfect.
I just want to thank Master for all his protection and grace to my family this year. I don't know if I can even... My granddaughters were in Stoney Douglas High School during the mass shooting in February 14th. And I got the call that there was an active shooter, and I started praying the Master like I've never prayed before for their protection. And I was driving, and I don't even remember driving, but I got home. And I just kept praying and praying and praying that they would be okay. Then I got the call from my daughter that everyone was safe, but my youngest granddaughter that was in a freshman classroom had to witness eight of her classmates shot and three of them were killed. And she's recovering from all this mentally, slowly but surely, but if you all pray for them. She was told when the classroom started, the English teacher said, we're going to go in groups today. And they don't do that too often, I don't think, but she said that day she went in groups. And when the shooting started, she went behind the teacher's desk. And while she was hiding there, she saw the boy that was in her seat, that they moved him around. He was in her seat. He was shot and killed, and he was in her band. And she saw and witnessed two others, and she's still going through a lot of pain and fear, waking up at night, not being able to sleep by herself. So I'm so thankful to Master that he saved her and her sister, who was in another classroom, but wasn't in the room that was shot into. But I just pray for the families that had to witness this. I have to go through the pain of losing the children and the pain that everyone saw in that classroom that day, those children. And I just thank Master every day, and I ask for your prayers that you'll help them, you know, to get over the pain and suffering they're going through right now. And that's all I can say about it. Her name is Jade. And right now she goes to counseling through horse therapy. She goes to, every week she goes, and there's ponies, little tiny miniature ponies, and she sits and she breathes into their noses. There was some kind of therapy through nose, and she breathes into their noses, and they just shut their eyes, and they go right to sleep, and that's helping her through her depression or her fears, you know, so she's getting better, and her friends that were in her classroom, they're trying to heal too. So I just pray that since we're so close to Master and he's so close to us, that you'll help, you know, pray for their healing.
sort of on what you're saying and what Dave, you were saying. And this is not my experience. This is my stepfather's experience, John Tracy.
So, who are you?
I'm Sally, actually, I'm Sally Whackham now, but I was Sally Robinson. And John Tracy was initiated when he was 19. So, John, we grew up and he came to Satsang here and heard all these wonderful stories. Everybody's stories, and he had never met Master. So he felt that he was not, you know, he wasn't for me, but it was, gosh, I wish that I could say something like that. I wish I could. And I remember him sitting and listening, you know, to everybody. So this was several times ago in Lake Janeska, John told the story, and he said, one day in the early 2000s, I think, Charlie and Jenny were at he and Mama's house in Charlotte. And John started telling the story of when he was initiated. It came up and he said, Charlie, you took me up to, I think it was Virginia, Washington, to get initiated. And Jenny and Charlie both get this weird look on their face. And Jenny goes, John, that's impossible because we were in India at that time with Master. Master was leaving the body. And John goes, no, that's not possible because, Charlie, you drove me in your car. You picked me up at my mother's house and drove me. And Jimmy said again, that's impossible. And Charlie's like, no, we were in India. So John goes, I have the piece of paper that you signed, Charlie, that shows that you were there and took me. So he goes and gets the piece of paper and shows it to Charlie and Jenny. And everybody's astounded. And they say, what happened? Can you tell us what happened? So John says, well, I was at my mother's house, and Charlie had called and said, we need to get you initiated. And we need to go up to Washington, D.C. to do it. We have a group leader who can do this. And John goes, okay. So Charlie said, I'll come and pick you up. So John's ready, and Master comes in the car, and John gets in the car. Sorry, Charlie. Gets in Charlie, ahead of myself. And John remembers that Charlie was, you know, not terribly emotional. And they back out of the parking, the driveway, and Charlie runs over a piece of liliope. And he gets out, and he picks up the liliope, and he plants it back again very carefully. And he gets back in the car, and John thinks, well, that's kind of odd for Charlie to do, but okay. So they drive along, and he realizes that although Charlie has been digging in the dirt, there's no dirt on Charlie's hands. And he kind of notes that. So they drive and they drive, and they get to Washington, and they have to go to several different places to finally get a group leader to initiate John, and it's very important it's done now. So John gets initiated, Charlie gets him back in the car, and they are driving back, and it's quiet. There's not a lot of talk. And John mentions something, I can't remember what it was, but he mentions something, and Charlie turns to John and says, I'm only interested in the subtlest of the subtle. And John's thinking, well, what does that mean exactly? So he gets back, and Charlie drops him at his mother's house and takes off. This was not Charlie Fulcher. Charlie Fulcher was in India in the summer of 74 when he was leaving the body. Charlie and Jenny were in India. Master picked up John Tracy, took him to Washington, initiated him, and brought him back. And that was John Tracy's very special, special, special story.
Oh, yeah.
That is his story. And all of us that were there and heard it were just, I know I was simply astounded and so heartful for John to have something so wonderful. And all these years going, gosh, I wish I'd had. Wow.
You did.
I'm happy, sorry.
This is for all you sinners out there who aren't doing what you're supposed to be doing. I got initiated when I was 10, master at Master Compton Charlie Fulcher's house in 1972. And Mama, the way that she got a hold of this was that I was in second grade and Charlie was doing the Great Concepts class. So I don't know how I got this piece of paper, but Mama says I brought it home from school. I walked home from Selwyn Elementary in Charlotte and gave it to her. And she had just gotten divorced from my dad and was very lonely and went to Charlie's class. So from there on, you know, of course, Master leads her to initiation, and she wanted me and Tommy, my middle brother, to be initiated. And we're a family of initiates, which is amazing, at Master's grace. But so we go, and we're initiated into Bhajan, and we're little. And so, you know, you drift, and I get into my teenage years, and I drift, and I get to college, and I drift more. And doing all the things I'm not supposed to be doing. Forget meditation. It's even worse than that. So I get into my 20s, and I'm unhappy, and I'm drifting, and life is not where it's supposed to be, and I've got a job, and I've graduated college and a career. And it's just not good. So one night, early in the morning, and you've heard this story, all you know, stories and one, I'm lying in bed in a half sleep. And I have this dream, and I dream that I'm in India, and I'm walking down a path on next to a large river, and there are these rocks, these large flat rocks in the middle of the river, and I'm standing there thinking, why am I here in India? And I've never been to India. And all of a sudden, Master comes down, walks down the hill, walks right past me, and I'm going, oh my God, there's Master. And he walks across the water. And he sits on the flat rock. And he looks over at me and he goes, come here. And I say, no, I can't walk across, I can't swim, I'll drown. And it ends. It goes on for 3 days. And I always think, three, Peter, three, you know, so three is big. So the third day, he does the same thing, he comes down, and he's by himself. And he walks across to the stone, across the water to the big flat rock, and he sits. And he looks at me and he goes, come here. And I said, no, I can't. I'll drown. And he goes, no, I will help you. I will save you. You're not going to drown. And I woke up and I went, oh my gosh, I've got to do something. And I called my mother. I said, send me all of Master's books right now. Send me Master's books, all that you have, and make sure you send me the diary. And from then on, it was better. But it's, you know, a good story, and he is always watching. And I have to think that the older I get, no matter what I do, I just do my best. I keep my diary, I meditate, I treat other people the way that I should, and I pray to Master to help me, to help not to be angry with people or confused with people or impatient, which are my bad flaws, and to love more. And I have to think that I try not to do too much navel-gazing, that Master is going to take care of us, that he does have us right where he wants us, and that even if we do things that he might not like, that he loves us, like you said, he loves us terribly, so much that he says, if you knew how much I loved you, you'd be dancing all around.
The thing in the excerpt from Harmony Grove, Master says, you can change. God wills it.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.